on the way. Consolata, however, paid scant attention to Mary Magdalene's words. She wasn't going anywhere. She would live in the field if she had to, or better, in the fire-ruined house that had become her mind's home. 3 times now she had followed him through it, balancing on buckled floorboards and smelling 12-year-old smoke. Out there, with not even a tree line in view, like a house built on the sand waves of the lonely Sahara, with no one or thing to hinder it, the house had burned freely in the play of wind and its own preen. Had it begun at night, with children asleep, or was it unoccupied when flames first seethed? Was the husband 60 acres away, bundling, branding, clearing, sowing? The wife stooped over a washtub in the yard, wisps of hair irritating her forehead. She would have thrown a bucket or two then, yelling to the children, rushed to collect what she could, piling everything she could reach, snatch, into the yard. Surely they had a bell, a rusty triangle, something to ring or bang to warn the other of advancing danger. When the husband got there, the smoke would have forced him to cry, but only the smoke, for they were not crying people. He would have worried first about the stock and guided them to safety or set them free, remembering that he had no property insurance. Other than what lay in the yard, all was lost, even the sunflowers at the northwest corner of the house near the kitchen, where the wife could see them while stirring hominy. Consolata ferreted in drawers where field mice had nibbled propane gas receipts, saw how the wind had smoothed charred furniture to silk. Neither shapes had taken over the space from which humans had fled, a kind of statuary of ash people. A man, 8 feet tall, hovered near the fireplace, his legs, sturdy cowboy legs, and the set of his jaw as he faced them answered immediate questions of domain. The finger at the tip of his long black arm pointed left towards sky, where a wall had crumbled, demanding quick exit from his premises. Near the pointing man, faintly etched on the ochre wall, was a girl with butterfly wings 3 feet long. The opposite wall was inhabited by what Consolata thought were fishmen, but the living man said no, more like Eskimo eyes. Eskimo? She asked, bunching her hair away from her neck. What's an Eskimo? He laughed, and obeying the cowboy's order, pulled her away, over the rubble of the collapsed wall, back to the gully, where they competed with the fig trees for holding on to one another. Mid-October, he skipped a week. A Friday came, and Consolata waited for 2.5 hours where the dirt road met the tarmac. She would have waited longer, but Penny and Clarissa came and led her away. He must be dead, she thought, and no one to tell her so. All night she fretted on her pallet, in the pantry, or hunched in darkness at the kitchen table. Morning found her watching the world of living things dribbling away with his absence. Her heart, clogged with awfulness, weakened. Her veins seemed to have turned into crinkly cellophane tubes. The heaviness in her chest was gaining weight so fast she was unable to breathe properly. Finally, she decided to find out or find him. Saturday was a busy day in those parts. The once-a-week bus honked her out of the way as she strode down the middle of the county road. Consolata skittered to the shoulder and kept on, her unbraided hair lifting in the breeze of the tailpipe. A few minutes later, an oil truck passed her, its driver yelling something through the window. Half an hour later, there was a glistening in the distance. A car? A truck? Him? Her heart gurgled and began to seep blood back into her cellophane veins. She dared not let the smile growing in her mouth spread to her face. Nor did she stop walking while the vehicle came slowly into view. Yes, dear God, a truck. And one person at the wheel, my Jesus. And now it slowed. Consolata turned to watch it come full stop and to feast on the living man's face. He leaned out of the window, smiling. Want a lift? Consolata ran across the road and darted around to the passenger door. By the time she got there, it was open. She climbed in, and for some reason, a feminine desire to scold or annihilate 24 hours of desperation, to pretend at least that the suffering he had caused her required an apology, an explanation to win her forgiveness, some instinct like that, preserved her, and she did not let her hand slip into his crotch as it wanted to. He was silent, of course, but it was not the silence of the Friday noon pickups. Then the unspeaking was lush with promise, easy, vocal. This silence was barren, a muteness lined with acid. And then she noticed the smell. Not unpleasant, not at all, but not his. Consolata froze. Then, not daring to look at his face, she glanced sideways at his feet. He was wearing not the black high tops, but cowboy boots, convincing her that a stranger sat behind the steering wheel, inhabiting the body of him, but not him. She thought to scream, to throw herself out onto the road. She would fight him if he touched her. She had no time to imagine other options, because they were approaching the dirt road that led to the convent. She was just about to fling open the door when the stranger braked and slowed to a standstill. He leaned over, brushing her breasts with his arm, and lifted the door handle. She stepped down quickly and turned to see. He touched the brim of his Stetson, smiling. "Anytime," he said. "Anytime at all." She backed away, staring at the exact face of him, repelled by, but locked into his eyes, chaste and wide with hatred. The incident does not halt the fig tree meetings. He comes the next Friday, wearing the right shoes and exuding the right smell, and they argue a little. What did he do? Nothing. He didn't even ask me where I was going, just drove me back. Good thing he did. Why? Did both of us a favor. No, he didn't. He was... what? I don't know. What'd he say to you? He said, want a lift. And then he said, anytime. Like he'd do it again. I could tell he doesn't like me. Probably not. Why should he? You want him to like you? No, oh no, but what? Consolata sits up straight and looks steadily toward the back of the fire-ruined house. Something brown and furry scurries into what is left of a charred rain barrel. You talk to him about me? She asks. Never told him a thing about you. Then how did he know I was coming to find you? Maybe he didn't. Maybe he just didn't think you should be walking to town like that. He didn't turn the truck around. He was driving north. That's why I thought it was you. Look, he says. He squats on his haunches, tossing pebbles. We have to have a signal. I can't always show up on Fridays. Let's think of something so you'll know. They thought of nothing that would work. In the end, she told him she would wait the Fridays, but only for an hour. He said, if I'm not on time, I'm not coming at all. The regularity of their meetings before his twin showed up had smoothed her hunger to a blunt blade. Now irregularity knifed it. Even so, twice more, he carried her off to the place where fig trees insisted on life. She did not know it then, but the second time was the last. It is the end of October. He walls a portion of the fire-ruined house with a horse blanket, and they lie on an army-issue bedroll. The pale sky above them is ringed with a darkness coming, which they could not have seen had they looked. So the falling snow that lights her hair and cools his wet back surprises them. Later, they speak of their situation. Blocked by weather and circumstance, they talk mostly about where. He mentions a town 90 miles north, but corrects himself quickly because no motel or hotel would take them. She suggests the convent because of the hiding places in it everywhere. He snorts his displeasure. Listen, she whispers. There is a small room in the cellar. No, wait, just listen. I'll fix it, make it beautiful. With candles, it's cool and dark in the summer, warm as coffee in the winter. We'll have a lamp to see each other with, but nobody can see us. We can shout as loud as we want, and nobody can hear. Pears are down there, and walls of wine. The bottles sleep on their sides, and each one has a name, like Veuve Clicquot or Medoc, and a number, 1915 or 1926, like prisoners waiting to be freed. Do it, she urges him. Please do it. Come to my house. While he considers, her mind races ahead with plans. Plans to cram rosemary into the pillow slips, rinse linen sheets in hot water steeped in cinnamon. They will slake their thirst with the prisoner wine, she tells him. He laughs, a low, satisfied laugh, and she bites his lip, which, in retrospect, was her big mistake. Consolata did all of it and more. The cellar room sparkled in the light of an 8-holder candelabra from Holland and reeked of ancient herbs. Seckle pears crowded a white bowl, none of which pleased him, for he never arrived, never felt the slide of old linen on his skin, or picked flakes of stick cinnamon from her hair. The 2 wine glasses she rescued from straw-filled crates and polished to abnormal clarity collected dust particles. Then, by November, just before Thanksgiving, an industrious spider moved in. Penny and Clarissa had washed their hair and sat by the stove, finger combing it dry. Every now and then, one of them would lean and shake a shiny black panel of it closer to the heat, softly singing forbidden Algonquinian lullabies. They watched Consolata just as they always did, her days of excitement, of manic energy, her slow change to nail-biting distraction. They liked her because she was stolen, as they had been, and felt sorry for her too. They regarded her behavior as serious instruction about the limits and possibilities of love and imprisonment, and took the lesson with them for the balance of their lives. Now, however, their instant future claimed priority. Bags packed, plans set, they needed only money. Where do you keep the money, Consolata? Please, Consolata. Wednesday, they take us to the correctional. Just a little, Consolata. In the pantry, yes. Well, where? Where was $1.20 from Monday alone? Consolata ignored them. Stop pestering me. We helped you, Consolata. Now you must help us. It's not stealing. We worked hard here. Please, think how hard we worked. Their voices chanting, soothing, they swayed their hair and looked at her with the glorious eyes of maidens in peril. The knock on the kitchen door was not loud, but its confidence was unmistakable. Three taps, no more. The girls still their hair in their hands. Consolata rose from her chair as if summoned by the sheriff or an angel. In a way it was both, in the shape of a young woman, exhausted, breathing hard, but ramrod straight. "That's some walk," she said. "Please, let me sit." Penny and Clarissa disappeared like smoke. The young woman took the chair Penny had vacated. "Can I get you something?" asked Consolata. "Water, would you? Not tea? You look froze." "Yes, but water first, then some tea." Consolata poured water from a pitcher and bent to check the stove fire. "What's that smell?" asked the visitor. "Sage?" Consolata nodded. The woman covered her lips with her fingers. "Does it bother you?" "It'll pass, thank you." She drank the water slowly until the glass was empty. Consolata knew, or thought she did, but asked anyway, "What is it you want?" "Your help." Her voice was soft, noncommittal, no judgment, no pleading. "I can't help you." "You can if you want to." "What kind of help are you looking for?" "I can't have this child." Hot water splashed from the spout to the saucer. Consolata put down the kettle and sopped the water with a towel. She'd never seen the woman, girl, really, not out of her 20s. But there was no confusion from the moment she stepped inside about who she was. His scent was all over her, or hers was all over him. They had lived together close enough, long enough, to breathe flux and cami soap and tobacco and to exhale it in their wake. That and some other thing, the scent of small children, the lovely aroma of sweet oil, baby powder, and a meatless diet. This was a mother here, saying a brute, unmotherly thing that rushed at Consolata like a forked tongue. She dodged the tongue, but the toxin behind it shocked her with what she had known but never imagined. She was sharing him with his wife. Now she saw the pictures that represented exactly what that word, sharing, meant. "I can't help you with that. What's wrong with you? I've had 2 children in 2 years. If I have another..." "Why come to me? Why are you asking me? Who else?" asked the woman in her clear, matter-of-fact voice. The poison spread. Consolata had lost him completely, forever. His wife might not know it, but Consolata remembered his face, not when she bit his lip, but when she had hummed over the blood she licked it from. He'd sucked air sharply, said he'll never do that again. But his eyes, first startled, then revolted, had said the rest of what she should have known right away. Clover, cinnamon, soft old linen, who would chance pears and a wall of prisoner wine with a woman bent on eating him like a meal? "You get on out of here. You didn't come here for that. You came to tell me, show me what you're like, and you think I'll stop when I know what you're willing to do? Well, I won't." "No, but he will." "You wouldn't have come here if you thought so. You want to see what I'm like, if I'm pregnant too. Listen to me. He can't fail at what he's doing. None of us can. We are making something. What do I care about your raggedy little town? Get out. Go on. I have work to do." "Did you walk all the way home? Or was that a lie, too? Was her car parked somewhere near? Or if she did walk, did nobody pick her up? Is that why she lost the baby? Her name was Soane, and when she and Consolata became fast friends, Soane told her she didn't think so. It was the evil in her heart that caused it. Arrogance, dripping with self-righteousness, she said. Pretending a sacrifice she had no intention of making taught her not to fool with God's ways. The life she offered as a bargain fell between her legs in a swamp of red fluids and wind-blown sheets. Their friendship was some time coming. In the meanwhile, after the woman left, Consolata threw a cloth bag of coins at Penny and Clarissa, shouting, "Get out of my face." While the light changed, and the meals did too, the next few days were one long siege of sorrow, during which Consolata picked through the scraps of her gobble-gobble love. Romance, stretched to the breaking point, broke, exposing a simple, mindless transfer from Christ, to whom one gave total surrender and then swallowed the idea of his flesh, to a living man. Shame, shame without blame. Consolata virtually crawled back to the little chapel, wishing fervently that he could be there, glowing red in the dim light. Scuttled back, as women do, as into arms, understanding where the body, like a muscle spasm, has no memory of its cringe. No beseeching prayer emerged, no domine, non sum dignus. She simply bent the knees she had been so happy to open and said, "Dear Lord, I didn't want to eat him. I just wanted to go home." Mary Magna came into the chapel and, kneeling with her, put an arm around Consolata's shoulder, saying, "At last." "You don't know," said Consolata. "I don't need to, child." But he, "Sha, sha, 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 sha," she wanted to say, meaning he and I are the same. "Sh, sh, 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 sh," said Mary Magna. "Never speak of him again." She might not have agreed so quickly, but as Mary Magna led her out of the chapel into the schoolroom, a sunshot seared her right eye, announcing the beginning of her bat vision, and she began to see best in the dark. Consolata had been spoken to. Mary Magna spent money she could not afford to take the household on a trip to Middleton, where each of them, but especially Consolata, confessed and attended Mass. Clarissa and Penny, models of penitence, urged without success a visit to the Indian and Western Museum advertised on the road. Sister Mary Elizabeth said it was an unwise way to spend post-confessional time. The long ride back was silent, except for the shish of missal pages turning and occasional humming from the last of the school's clientele. Soon, only Mother and Sister Roberta were left. Sister Mary Elizabeth accepted a teaching post in Indiana. Penny and Clarissa had been taken east and, as was later learned, escaped from the bus one night in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Except for a money order made out to Consolata and signed with a storybook name, they were never heard from again. The three women spent the winter waiting, then not waiting, for some alternative to retirement or a home. The independence the mission was designed for was beginning to feel like abandonment. Meanwhile, they took steps to keep up the property and not incur debt the foundation could not meet. Sergeant Person agreed to lease land from them for rough corn and alfalfa. They made sauces and jellies and European bread, sold eggs, peppers, hot relish, and angry barbecue sauce, which they advertised on a square of cardboard covering the faded blue and white name of the school. Most of their customers in 1955 drove trucks between Arkansas and Texas. Ruby citizens seldom stopped to buy anything other than peppers, since they were supreme cooks themselves and made or grew what they wanted. Only in the 60s, when times were fat, did they join the truckers and look upon what they called convent bred chickens as superior enough to their own to be worth a journey. Then they would also try a little jalapeno jelly or a corn relish. Pecan saplings planted in the 40s were strong in 1960. The convent sold the nuts, and when pies from the harvest were made, they went as soon as posted. They made rhubarb pie so delicious it made customers babble, and the barbecue sauce got a heavenly reputation based on the hellfire peppers. It was an all right life for Consolata, better than all right, for Mary Magna had taught her patience as the first order of business. After arranging for her confirmation, she had taken the young Consolata aside, and together they would watch coffee brew or sit in silence at the edge of the garden. God's generosity, she said, is nowhere better seen than in the gift of patience. The lesson held Consolata in good stead, and she hardly noticed the things she was losing. The first to go were the rudiments of her first language. Every now and then she found herself speaking and thinking in that in-between place, the valley between the regulations of the first language and the vocabulary of the second. The next thing to disappear was embarrassment. Finally, she lost the ability to bear light. By the time Mavis arrived, Sister Roberta had gone into a nursing home, and Consolata had nothing on her mind but the care of Mary Magna. But before that, before the disheveled woman in thong slippers hollered at the edge of the garden, before Mary Magna's illness, still in a state of devotion and light blindness, and 10 years after that summer of hiding in a gully behind a house full of inhospitable ash people, Consolata was tricked into raising the dead. They were subdued years, penance attended to, but not all-consuming. There was time and mind for everyday things. Consolata learned to manage any and everything that did not require paper. She perfected the barbecue sauce that drove the cattle country people wild, quarreled with the chickens, gave hateful geese a wide berth, and tended the garden. She and Sister Roberta had agreed to try again for a cow, and Consolata was standing in the garden, wondering where to pin it, when sweat began to pour from her neck, her hairline like rain. So much it clouded the sunglasses she now wore. She removed the glasses to wipe the sweat from her eyes. Through that salty water, she saw a shadow moving toward her. When it got close, it turned into a small woman. Consolata, overcome with dizziness, tried to hold on to a bean pole, failed, and sank to the ground. When she woke, she was sitting in the red chair, the small woman humming while mopping her forehead. "Talk about luck," she said, and smiled around a wad of chewing gum. "What's happening to me?" Consolata looked toward the house. "Change, I expect. Here's your glasses, bent though." Her name was Lone Dupre, she said. And if she had not come for a few peppers, she said, Who knew how long Consolata would have lain in the snap beans? Consolata found herself too weak to stand, so she let her head fall back on the chair's crown and asked for water. "Uh-uh," said Lone. "You already got too much of that. How old are you?" 49, 50 soon. "Well, I'm over 70, and I know my stuff. You do as I say, your change will be easier and shorter. You don't know that's what this is? Bet on it. And it's not just the sweat. You feel something more, don't you? Like what? You'd know it if you had it. What's it feel like? You tell me. Some women can't stomach it. Others say it reminds them of, well, you know." "My throat is parched," said Consolata. Lone dug around in her bag. "I'll brew you something to help." "No, the sisters, I mean, they won't let you just walk on in and start messing on the stove." "Oh, they'll be fine." And they were. Lone gave Consolata a hot drink that tasted of pure salt. And when she described her spell and Lone's remedy to Mary Magna, she laughed, saying, "Well, the teacher I am thinks baloney. The woman I am thinks anything that helps, helps. But be very careful." Mary Magna lowered her voice. "I think she practices." Lone didn't visit often, but when she did, she gave Consolata information that made her uneasy. Consolata complained that she did not believe in magic, that the church and everything holy forbade its claims to knowingness and its practice. Lone wasn't aggressive. She simply said, "Sometimes folks need more." "Never," said Consolata. "In my faith, faith is all I need." "You need what we all need, earth, air, water. Don't separate God from his elements. He created it all. You stuck on dividing him from his works? Don't unbalance his world." Consolata listened half-heartedly. Her curiosity was mild, her religious habits entrenched. Her safety did not lie in the fall of a broom or the droppings of a coyote. Her happiness was not increased or decreased by the sight of a malformed animal. She fancied no conversation with water, nor did she believe that ordinary folk could or should interfere with natural consequences. The road from Demby, however, was straight as a saw, and a teenager driving it for the first time believed not only that he could drive it blindfolded, but that he could drive it in his sleep, which is what Scout Morgan was doing off and on as he traveled early one evening the road that passed the convent. He was 15 years old, driving his best friend's father's truck, which was nothing compared to the little deer his uncle taught him to handle. While his brother, Easter, slept in the truck bed and the best friend slept at his side. They had sneaked off to Red Fork to see the black rodeo all their fathers forbade them to attend and had drunk themselves happy with Falstaff beer. During one of Scout's involuntary naps at the wheel, the truck careened off the road and probably would have done no serious damage but for the roadside poles, stacked and ready to go as soon as the power crew was empowered to install them. The truck hit the poles and flipped. July, Person, and Easter were thrown out. Scout was stuck inside, crooked red lines highlighting the black skin of his temple. Lone, sitting at Consolata's table, sensed rather than heard the accident. The shouts of July and Easter could not have traveled that far. She rose and grabbed Consolata's arm. Come on. Where to? Close by, I think. When they arrived, Easter in July had pulled Scout from the cab and were howling over his dead body. Lone turned to Consolata, saying, I'm too old now. Can't do it anymore, but you can. Lift him? No. Go inside him. Wake him up. Inside? How? Step in. Just step on in. Help him, girl. Consolata looked at the body and without hesitation removed her glasses and focused on the trickles of red discoloring his hair. She stepped in, saw the stretch of road he had dreamed through, felt the flip of the truck, the headache, the chest pressure, the unwillingness to breathe. As from a distance, she heard Easter and July kicking the truck and moaning. Inside the boy, she saw a pinpoint of light receding. Pulling up energy that felt like fear, she stared at it until it widened, then more, more, so air could come seeping at first, then rushing, rushing in. Although it hurt like the devil to look at it, she concentrated as though the lungs in need were her own. Scout opened his eyes, groaned, and sat up. The women told the unhurt boys to carry him back to the convent. They hesitated, exchanging looks. Lone shouted, What the hell is the matter with you all? Both were profoundly relieved by Scout's recovery. But, no, ma'am, Miss Dupre, they said, we gotta get on home. Let's see if it still runs, said Easter. They righted the truck and found it sound enough to drive. Lone went with them, leaving Consolata half exhilarated by and half ashamed of what she had done. Practiced. Weeks passed before Lone returned to put her mind at ease about the boy's recovery. You gifted. I knew it from the start. Consolata turned her lips down and crossed herself, whispering, Ave Maria. Gracia plena. The exhilaration was gone now, and the thing seemed nasty to her, like devilment, like evil craft, something it would mortify her to tell Mary Magna, Jesus, or the Virgin. She hadn't known what she was doing. She was under a spell, Lone spell, and told her so. Don't be a fool. God don't make mistakes. Despising his gift now, that is a mistake. You calling him a fool, like you? I don't understand anything you're saying, Consolata told her. Yes, you do. Let your mind grow long and use what God gives you. I think he wants me to ignore you. Hard head, said Lone. She hoisted her bag and walked down the driveway to wait in the sun for her ride. Then Soane came, saying, Lone Dupre told me what you did. I came to thank you with all my heart. She looked much the same to Consolata, except that the long hair of 1954, sticky with distress, was cut now. She carried a basket and placed it on the table. You will be in my prayers forever. Consolata lifted the napkin. Round sugar cookies were layered between waxed paper. Mother will like these with her tea, she said. Then, looking at Soane, go nice with coffee, too. I'd love a cup, more than anything. Consolata placed the sugar cookies on a platter. Lone thinks, I don't care about that. You gave him back to me. A gander screamed in the yard, scattering the geese before him. I didn't know he belonged to you. I know you didn't. And it was something I couldn't help doing. I mean, it was out of my hands, so to speak. I know that too. What does he think? He thinks he saved himself. Maybe he's right. Maybe he is. What do you think? That he was lucky to have us both? Consolata shook crumbs from the basket and folded the napkin neatly inside. They traded that basket back and forth for years. Other than with Mary Magna, stepping in was of no use. There was no call for it. The light Consolata could not bear to approach her own eyes. She endured for the Reverend Mother when she became ill. At first, she tried it out of the weakness of devotion turned to panic. Nothing seemed to relieve the sick woman. Then, angered by helplessness, she assumed an attitude of command, stepping in to find the pinpoint of light, manipulating it, widening it, strengthening it, reviving, even raising her from time to time. And so intense were the steppings in, Mary Magna glowed like a lamp until her very last breath in Consolata's arms. So she had practiced, and although it was for the benefit of the woman she loved, she knew it was anathema, that Mary Magna would have recoiled in disgust and fury, knowing her life was prolonged by evil, that the bliss of that final entrance was being deliberately delayed by one who ought to know better. So Consolata never told her. Yet, however repugnant, the gift did not evaporate. Troubling as it was, yoking the sin of pride to witchcraft, she came to terms with it in a way she persuaded herself would not offend him or place her soul in peril. It was a question of language. Lone called it stepping in. Consolata said it was seeing in. Thus the gift was in sight, something God made free to anyone who wanted to develop it. It was devious, but it settled the argument between herself and Lone and made it possible for her to accept Lone's remedies for all sorts of ills and to experiment with others while the insight blazed away. The dimmer the visible world, the more dazzling her insight became. When Mary Magna died, Consolata was 54 years old, was orphaned in a way she was not as a street baby and was never as a servant. There was reason the church cautioned against excessive human love, and when Mary Magna left her, Consolata accepted the sympathy of her two friends, the help and murmurs of support from Mavis, the efforts to cheer her from Grace, but her rope to the world had slid from her fingers. She had no identification, no insurance, no family, no work, facing extinction, waiting to be evicted, wary of God. She felt like a curl of paper, nothing written on it, lying in the corner of an empty closet. They had promised to take care of her always, but did not tell her that always was not all ways, nor forever. Prisoner wine helped until it didn't, and she found herself full of a drinker's malice, wishing she had the strength to beat the life out of the women freeloading in the house. God don't make mistakes, Lone had shouted at her. Perhaps not, but he was sometimes overgenerous, like giving satanic gifts to a drunken, ignorant, penniless woman living in darkness, unable to rise from a cot to do something useful or die on it and rid the world of her stench. Gray-haired, her eyes drained of what eyes were made for, she imagined how she must appear. Her colorless eyes saw nothing clearly except what took place in the minds of others. exactly the opposite of that blind season when she rutted in dirt with the living man and thought she was seeing for the first time because she was looking so hard. But she had been spoken to, half cursed, half blessed. He had burned the green away and replaced it with pure sight that damned her if she used it. Footsteps, then a knock, interrupted her sad, dead-end thoughts. The girl opened the door. Connie? Who else? It's me, Pallas. I called my father again, so, you know, he's meeting me in Tulsa. I came to say goodbye. I see. It's been great. I needed to, well, it's been forever since I last saw him. That long? Can you believe it? Hard to. You fattened up. Yeah, I know. What will you do about it? Same as always. Diet. I don't mean that. I mean the baby. You're pregnant. I am not. No. No. Why not? I'm only 16. Oh, said Consolata, looking at the moon head floating above a spine. The four little appendages, paws, or hands, or hooves, or feet. Hard to tell at that stage. Pallas could be carrying a lamb, a baby, a jaguar. Pity, she said, as Pallas fled from the room. And pity again, as she imagined the child's probable life with its silly young mother. She remembered another girl about the same age who had come a few years ago at a very bad time. For 17 days, Consolata had been inside, alone, keeping Mary Magna's breath coming and going, the cool blue light flickering until Mary Magna asked permission to go, bereft though she was of that last sacrament. The second girl, Grace, had arrived in time to hold off the fearful loneliness that dropped the moment the body was removed, letting Consolata sleep. Mavis had just returned with Lourdes water and illegal painkillers. Consolata welcomed the company, which distracted her from the self-pitying thoughts of eviction, starvation, and an uncontrite death. Minus papers or patron, she was as vulnerable as she had been at 9 when she clung to Mary Magna's hand at the railing of the Etnas. Whatever help Lone Dupre or Soane might offer could not include shelter, not in that town. Then the girl from Ruby came, a cup of tears just behind her eyes, and something else. She was not anxious, as might have been expected, but revolted by the work of her womb. A revulsion so severe, it cut mind from body and saw its flesh-producing flesh as foreign, rebellious, unnatural, diseased. Consolata could not fathom what brought on that repugnance, but there it was, and here it was again in the no shout of another one, a terror without alloy. With the first one, Consolata did what she knew Mary Magna would have done, quieted the girl, and advised her to wait her time, told her that she was welcome to deliver there if she wanted to. Mavis was jubilant, Grace amused. They took the field rent and drove off to shop for the expected newborn, returning with booties and diapers and dolls enough for a kindergarten. The girl, sharp in her refusal to have the midwife attend her, waited quietly, sullen, for a week or so. Or so Consolata thought. What she did not know, until labor began, was that the young mother had been hitting her stomach relentlessly. Had Consolata's eyesight been better, and had the girl's skin not been black as an ocean lover's night, she would have seen the bruises at once. As it was, she saw swellings and wide areas where the skin showed purple underneath rather than silver. But the real damage was the mop handle inserted with a rapist's skill, mercilessly, repeatedly, between her legs. With the gusto and intention of a rabid male, she had tried to bash the life out of her life, and, in a way, was triumphantly successful. The 5 or 6 month baby revolted, feisty, outraged, rigid with fright. It tried to escape the battering and battered ship that carried it, the blows to its delicate skull, the trouncing its hind parts took, the shudders in its spine. Otherwise, there was no hope. Had it not tried to rescue itself, it would break into pieces or drown in its mother's food. So he was born, in a manner of speaking, too soon and fatigued by the flight. But breathing, sort of. Mavis took over. Grace went to bed. Together, Consolata and Mavis cleaned his eyes, stuck their fingers in his throat, clearing it for air, and tried to feed him. It worked for a few days. Then he surrendered himself to the company of Merle and Pearl. By that time, the mother was gone, having never touched, glanced at, inquired after, or named him. Grace called him Che, and Consolata did not know to this day where he was buried. Only that she had murmured, Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere nobis, over the 3 pounds of gallant but defeated life before Mavis, smiling and cooing, carried it away. Just as well, thought Consolata. Life with that mother would have been hell for Che. Now there was another one screaming no, as if that made it so. Pity. Reaching for a bottle, Consolata found it empty. She sighed and sat back in the chair. Without wine, her thoughts, she knew, would be unbearable. Resignation, self-pity, muted rage, disgust and shame glowing like cinders in a dying fire. As she rose to replenish her vice, a grand weariness took her, forcing her back to the seat, tipping her chin on her chest. She slept herself into sobriety. Headachy, sandy-mouthed, she woke in quick need of a toilet. On the second floor, she could hear sniffles behind one door, singing behind another. Back down the stairs, she decided to catch a little air and shuffled into the kitchen and out the door. The sun had gone, leaving behind a friendlier light. Consolata surveyed the winter-plagued garden. Tomato vines hung limp over fallen fruit, black and smashed in the dirt. Mustards were pale yellow with rot and inattention. A whole spill of melons caved in on themselves near heads of chrysanthemums stricken mud brown. A few chicken feathers were stuck to the low wire fencing, protecting the garden from whatever it could. Without human help, gopher holes, termite castles, evidence of rabbit forays, and determined crows abounded. The corn scrabble in neatly harvested fields beyond looked forlorn, and the pepper bushes, held on to by the wrinkled fingers of their yield, were rigid with cold. Despite the grains of soil blowing against her legs, Consolata sat down in the faded red chair. Non sum dignus, she whispered. But tell me, Where is the rest of days? The Isle of Time, the scent of Veronica you promised, the cream and honey you said I had earned, the happiness that comes of well-done chores, the serenity duty grants us, the blessings of good works. Was what I did for love of you so terrible? Mary Magna had nothing to say. Consolata listened to the refusing silence, more wondering than annoyed by the sky in plumage now, gold and blue-green, strutting like requited love on the horizon. She was afraid of dying alone, ungrieved, in unholy ground, but knew that was precisely what lay before her. How she longed for the good death. "I'll miss you," she told him. "I really will." The skylight wavered. A man approached, medium height, light step. He came right on up the drive. He wore a cowboy hat that hid his features, but Consolata couldn't have seen them anyway. Where he sat, on the kitchen steps, framed by the door, a triangle of shadow obscured his face, but not his clothes. A green vest over a white shirt, red suspenders hanging low on either side of his tan trousers, shiny black work shoes. "Who is that?" she asked. "Come on, girl. You know me." He leaned forward, and she saw that he wore sunglasses, the mirror type that glitter. "No," she said, "can't say I do." "Well, not important. I'm traveling here." There were 10 yards between them, but his words licked her cheek. "You from the town?" "Uh-uh, I'm far country. Got a thing to drink?" "Look, you in the house." Consolata was beginning to slide toward his language like honey oozing from a comb. "Oh, well," he said, as though that settled it, and he would rather go thirsty. "Just holler," said Consolata. "The girls can bring you something." She felt light, weightless, as though she could move, if she wanted to, without standing up. "Don't you know me better than that?" the man asked. "I don't want to see your girls. I want to see you." Consolata laughed. "You have your glasses much more me." Suddenly he was next to her, without having moved, smiling like he was having or expecting such a good time. Consolata laughed again. It seemed so funny, comical really, the way he had flitted over to her from the steps, and how he was looking at her, flirtatious, full of secret fun. Not 6 inches from her face, he removed his tall hat. Fresh, tea-colored hair came tumbling down, cascading over his shoulders and down his back. He took off his glasses then and winked, a slow, seductive movement of a lid. His eyes, she saw, were as round and green as new apples. In candlelight, on a bitter January evening, Consolata cleans, washes, and washes again 2 freshly killed hens. They are young, poor layers, with pen feathers difficult to extract. Their hearts, necks, giblets, and livers turn slowly in boiling water. She lifts the skin to reach under it, fingering as far as she can. Under the breast, she searches for a pocket close to the wing. Then, holding the breast in her left palm, the fingers of her right tunnel the back skin, gently pushing for the spine. Into all these places, where the skin has been loosened and the membrane separated from the flesh it once protected. She slides butter, thick, pale, slippery. Pallas wiped her eyes with the heel of her hand and then blew her nose. Now what? This latest phone call, which she had mentioned to Connie, was not very different from the initial one, just shorter. But it produced the same frustration as what had passed for conversation with her father last summer. Jesus Christ, where the hell are you? We thought you were dead. Thank God. They found the car, but it's bashed to hell on one side, and somebody stripped it. You okay? Oh, baby. Daddy. Where is he? Boy, is his ass over. Tell me what happened. Your bitch mother's not making any sense as usual. Did he hurt you? Daddy, no. Well, what? Was he alone? We're suing the school, baby. Got them by the short hairs. It wasn't him. Some boys chased me. What? In their truck. They hit my car and forced me off the road. I ran, and then they raped me.